Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Can you all hear me? Good. Now it's my pleasure to introduce the second lecture in this annual series of Robin's lectures by Professor Robert Barrow. I expect most of you heard the first lecture yesterday. It's quite clear that the dropout rate is zero, Robert, from the fact that every place is once again filled and some people are standing. And I'd just like to say a word of welcome on behalf of the Robbins family. Lionel Robbins, his son and daughter Richard and my wife Anne are here, and his widow Iris would have liked to be here, and she has indeed attended most of the Robbins lectures, but she has just passed her 99th birthday, and I'm sure you'll excuse her if she relies on us to give her a full report of the lectures from the notes which she expects us to take very copiously. Robert, the floor is yours.
Well, I wanted to continue on from my discussion of yesterday, particularly today, to focus on the interplay between economic forces, especially economic growth, and political variables, by which I will especially concentrate on measures of the extent of democracy prevalent in various countries. I think these days there's a fair consensus that measures of economic freedom are positive contributors to the rate of economic growth. So things like maintenance of the rule of law and security of property rights, those features are thought to contribute to investment and growth. And I think there's some empirical evidence supporting that viewpoint, such as some of the evidence that I discussed yesterday, where I tried to quantify the linkage between a rule of law kind of concept and the rate of economic growth. But I think the relation of economic growth and other economic variables to political freedom is much more controversial, both at the theoretical and empirical levels. Some kind of measure of democracy, and whether it fosters or hinders the rate of economic growth, I think is much less clear-cut. Moreover, this is quite a big issue in some parts of the world currently, especially in parts of Asia, where the question of whether to have more democratization or not, and whether that would hinder the rates of economic progress, is a very current kind of question that's being contemplated. Now, some theories have brought out the possible negative channels that could arise between more political freedom and subsequent rates of investment and economic growth. One kind of theory stresses the idea that if you have majority vote mechanisms, such voting behavior might be used to redistribute resources from rich minorities to poor majorities, and whether or not that is desirable on some counts, it would tend to have negative incentives for investment and growth. That's one possible channel by which more political freedom, in the sense of the usual measures of democracy, could prove to be adverse for rates of economic growth. Also, other theories have stressed the role of interest groups that can become strong in democratic systems. Interest groups producing legislation that would be desirable for them, but a hindrance for incentives to innovate and to invest could be another mechanism for a negative effect on rates of economic growth. It's also been argued that the possibilities of having economic reforms is hindered in a democratic system because it's hard to do anything very quickly in that kind of a setting. There are theories that go in the other direction, however. For example, if you have an autocrat whose main interests are toward generating own wealth, then if you have more democratization, that tends to be a constraint on that process, and that could be desirable. Similarly, democratization might prevent a political leader from carrying out various kinds of unproductive policies which would hinder rates of economic growth. It's also been stressed by Mansur Olson recently that an autocrat cannot possibly commit him or herself not to change his mind and change the rules. That it's hard to have a dictator who has absolute power committing to a given set of policies because it's always easy to change later on. And therefore, he has argued that democracy could be more growth promoting on this ground because there'd be more capacity for making commitments. I think overall, on a theoretical level, the net effect of more or less democracy on economic progress is unclear because there are these opposing forces. And I'm mainly going to focus here on the empirical evidence on that question, which I'm going to get to in a moment. There's also the reverse direction of effect, a much more longer standing idea that as countries become more prosperous, measured in various ways, they tend to become more politically free and democratic. This is an idea which is now often called the Lipset hypothesis, after Seymour Martin Lipset, who wrote an article on this in 1959, arguing that in order to sustain democracy, countries had to first achieve a certain level of economic progress, measured either in terms of per capita income or education or in other ways. Although this idea is now called typically the Lipset hypothesis, Lipset himself seems to like to attribute it to Aristotle. And indeed, if you go back and read Aristotle, he did suggest that the only way you were going to be able to sustain democracy is if you first achieved some kind of minimal level of average economic progress, and in particular, if there wasn't a lot of poverty in the economy. Now, the theories, such as they are in this area, stress things like the role of education, the middle class, the idea that you want various kinds of private societies and groups that represent countervailing power to the government. That's particularly an idea that was focused on by Tocqueville in thinking about the nature of democracy in the United States of America. It's not clear to me that this adds up to a lot in terms of theoretical reasoning. And I certainly do not find the theoretical arguments that I've read in this field, most of which is in political science, to be all that compelling. On the other hand, I think the empirical regularity is very well established, as I'll argue a little later when I discuss my own empirical work on this question. I think the general idea that economic progress tends to foster more political freedom is very clear in the data. So it's kind of a case where the empirical evidence is much stronger than the theory, whereas when we look at the other evidence from democracy to growth, we have a number of interesting theories, although they have opposite directions, and I think the empirical evidence is much less clear. So it's a little bit confused on these two directions of causation as to where we stand in terms of theory and where we stand in terms of empirical evidence. So I want to discuss first this direction from democracy or political rights to economic growth and what the empirical evidence is on that. And of course, I'm going to carry out this investigation within the framework that I developed and discussed last time. I should say first that I'm going to use a particular measure of democracy or political rights, which has the attraction of being available in a broad panel of data, basically from the beginning of the 1970s until today on an annual basis. This is a so-called Gastiel Index of Political Rights, which is a subjective measure originally grading countries on a scale from 1 to 7 as to how politically free they were. I've converted that measure here to an index from 0 to 1, where 0 represents least democratic and 1 represents more democratic. I think one can make a lot of arguments about whether the characterizations that are employed in this index are correct or not in particular cases. But I think in a broad sense, the results are quite reasonable. And a number of people have argued that some alternative measures for various portions of the time period correlate pretty closely with this one. I've also supplemented the Gastiel data with some alternative measures to get the information back to 1960. Really have some data for 1960 and 1965. So I'll be looking overall at the period from 1960 up to 1994, which is the last data that I have. If you look at figures 10 to 12, you can see something about the nature of this index of democracy in my sample, which is of over 100 countries. Figure 10 just shows you the average across all the countries in the sample of this democracy indicator, which, as I mentioned, is measured on a 0 to 1 scale, where 1 indicates essentially full representative democracy and 0 represents essentially no political rights. To quantify matters, places like the United States and most of the Western European countries are labeled as having 1.0 on this scale. They're deemed to be full democracies in the sense of this indicator. Places like Mexico, at least in 1994, and Malaysia are scaled at about 1/2. Now, the measure is intended to focus on the role of elections and elected representatives. It wants to see whether elections are free, whether people are allowed to participate both in the voting and in running for office, whether the people who are elected actually have a decisive influence on policies that are put into play. And the measure also, in a subjective sense, tends to grade down the democracy if minority parties have no influence whatsoever on policies. That, I think, is a much looser concept, but it's implemented to some degree in the measure. So as I indicated, Mexico and Malaysia are about 1/2 on this scale. Places like Syria and China in 1994, for example, are measured as having 0, no political rights. As was also true of Haiti before the U.S. Marines went in and set everything right relatively recently. So if you look at figure 10, that shows you the pattern in the overall time series from 1960 to 1994. You should keep in mind that the data points plotted are actually only for 1960, 1965, and then annually from 1972. Those are the data I have available. You can see democracy in this sense peaked at the beginning of the sample, 1960, and then declined quite rapidly through the middle 1970s. And since then, there's been a gradual increase in the average amount of democracy as measured in this manner. Now, one of the main patterns behind this overall world trend is the experience in sub-Saharan Africa, which is shown separately in figure 11. I should say that the overall index, which is for 130-something countries, is weighting each country equally. It's just an average. And there are about 40 countries in Africa, so it actually has a pretty big weight as measured in this unweighted manner in the overall global average. Figure 11 shows you just the African experience. What happened in that case is that many of these places, when they were newly independent in the early 1960s, were set up initially as nice representative democracies, and they were rated accordingly by this index. But most of them became one-party dictatorships by the early 1970s, and that's the source of the dramatic decline in the democracy indicator in Africa from the beginning, 1960, through the early and middle 1970s. You'll also notice in the diagram that since 1989, there's been a marked increase in average democracy in Africa. There have been a number of very sharp democratizations, and a big question is whether or not those will be sustained. One of those cases, of course, is South Africa, but the democratizations have also occurred in several other places in Africa since roughly the end of the 1980s. Figure 12 shows you what happens outside of sub-Saharan Africa. The scale is different here. Actually, the amount of change is much smaller than it is in the African case. You can see there was, again, an overall decline till the middle 70s, but then the restoration of democracy has produced a level which was slightly above that at the beginning of the sample in this case. Anyway, that's just indicating some of the nature of the data of political rights that I'm going to be using in my empirical investigation. I've also looked at another measure which comes from the same source, from this Gastiel source, of a broader concept of civil liberties, which instead of measuring something in detail about the electoral process, is another subjective measure of things like freedom of speech, religion, assembly, and so on, and also various kinds of rights in the legal system. In practice, however, that indicator is extremely highly correlated with the measure of political freedom. I think that's because civil liberties and political freedom actually tend to move together, rather than the fact that Gastiel was the person who measured both of them. I think, in fact, these kinds of things tend to go together. So it turns out in the empirical work that anything I say basically about democracy also holds for these measures of civil liberties, and it wouldn't make too much difference if you use one rather than the other, or some kind of average of the two, which some researchers have done. Now, I should say that's very different in terms of the behavior of economic freedom, in particular the kind of rule of law, also subjective concept that I used yesterday. That's much less correlated with either political freedom or civil liberties. There tend to be a lot more cases where you have a lot of economic rights, but not political rights and not civil liberties, whereas you don't tend to find cases where you have a lot of political freedom without civil liberties. Those tend to go together in a much more complementary fashion. Well, one thing one can do in terms of the framework that I discussed yesterday is one can include, as I actually did in the tables that I handed out last time, a measure of democracy, this Gastiel indicator of political rights, as one of the explanatory variables in the system that's explaining per capita growth rates. Now, it turns out if you just add a measure of political rights or democracy to the system that I discussed last time, if you just enter it in a linear fashion, what you get is that there's a slight but not statistically significant negative relation between democracy and subsequent rates of economic growth. But I wouldn't put a lot of stress on that, because I say the point estimate is negative, but it's not at all even close to being statistically significant. To get a better idea about the relationship, you can look at figure 13. This is the same kind of construct that I used in my discussions last time. On the horizontal axis is the indicator of political rights or democracy. Basically, that's observed three times for each country as long as the data are available. So each country actually ends up being represented by 3 points in this diagram, but at different points in time. On the vertical axis, you get the growth rate of real per capita gross domestic product, but net of the estimated influence of all the other variables that I was discussing last time, including the initial position with respect to per capita income and the other kinds of variables, human capital and the policy variables that I discussed last time. So all those are being held constant. This is picking up a partial relation between economic growth and the political setup basically at the beginning of each of the relevant periods. Now, I purposely didn't draw a line through this diagram because I didn't want to influence you about what you thought the partial relationship was between economic growth and the initial level of political rights. I don't know what you think if you look at this scatter plot. As I already mentioned, if you just fit a straight line through the points, a regression or least squares line, you get a slight negative slope, but it's not statistically significant. I think if you stare at the diagram a little more intently, you might convince yourself, this is in the eye of the beholder, I guess, that there's a nonlinear relationship where at the low level of democracy, remember zero represents no political freedom, there's an upward inclined relationship, so that going from zero democracy to something positive looks like on average it might be increasing the growth rate. And then you might believe that there's a peak there, and then subsequently it's coming down. And particularly, you notice there's a lot of points right at the end that are 1.0, which are basically the main developed countries. And you'll notice that their growth rate is not particularly high. It's sort of lower than average, that it has negative residuals here. So you might convince yourself that there's a nonlinear relation initially with a positive slope and subsequently with a negative slope. And indeed, if you do the statistical analysis and allow it to fit that kind of nonlinear relationship, the data kind of like that, and that is highly statistically significant. But I didn't draw it in here because, again, I didn't want to prejudice what you thought that relationship looked like. Now, a possible story behind that relationship would be that if you're talking about the worst dictatorships, which are democracy levels at or close to zero, that in that kind of environment, the critical thing is to get some kind of constraint on the absolute power of the ruler, and that that would in particular constrain public policies away from things that are just transferring resources to the leader. And here one would think about cases like the Philippines under Marcos and various countries in Africa and in Latin America. There are a lot of examples of dictatorships that seem to look that way. The rest of the story would be that if you get a reasonable or middle level of democracy, and I mentioned the benchmark here would be Mexico and Malaysia, for example, in recent times, that if you go beyond that, that the thing that dominates is this pressure towards redistribution, pressure towards social programs, which you might like if you like redistribution, but they tend to be adverse in terms of incentives and tend to curtail the rate of investment and growth. So the story would be, if you go beyond this sort of intermediate level of democracy, that on net, as you get more political freedom, it's adverse for growth. That would be a story behind this apparent relationship. So if you believe that, that would say that places like Malaysia and Mexico will lose in terms of growth if they become more democratic than they have been recently. It would also say that various places that have democratized to a considerable extent during the sample period, included in which would be places like Chile and Korea and Taiwan, the story here would be that on net, that's going to be adverse for growth, that it's gone beyond the point which would maximize the rate of economic progress. That doesn't mean it's undesirable to have more democracy, but you have to justify it for other reasons, like you like political freedom or you like redistribution. You can't justify it on the grounds that it's going to foster a higher rate of economic growth. That doesn't seem to be in the data. And indeed, as I mentioned, this is a big concern in many East Asian countries. And I think many people in Korea believe that they've gone too far because they're very obsessed with the rate of economic growth. And certainly this is a compelling issue in Singapore as to whether or not to have democratization beyond the low level that's been currently achieved. I also find for Singapore that if you talk to government officials, they say they already have full democracy. And they observe that they've had elections which they describe as free for many years. And I find if I talk to anybody else who lives in Singapore, especially students, they believe they have essentially no political freedom and that their democracy is roughly zero. According to the Gastiel indicator, it's about 0.3, which is below the sort of midpoint, but not comparable to Syria and China. Well, again, if I look at the relationship in figure 13, I would say that democracy doesn't look particularly like it's the key to economic growth one way or another. Certainly you have cases of harsh dictatorships which have grown rapidly. Recent examples of that would be China, Singapore, if you view Singapore as having no democracy, Korea and Taiwan in earlier periods, Chile in earlier periods. You have numbers of examples like that. You also have dictatorships which have done very badly. Similarly, you have democracies that have done well and democracies that have done poorly. So I don't think you can say from this that democracy is the key to growth and that you need democracy in order to grow. But I'd say on net, I have this kind of relationship that I've already sketched, but I wouldn't regard it as one of the more firmly established empirical regularities overall. So let me now switch my discussion to the other direction of causation. This Aristotle-Lipset idea that the accumulation of growth, as it shows up in levels of prosperity measured in various ways, would tend to contribute to a climate that fosters democracy. Or to put it another way, if you don't have enough income per head and you don't have enough education, etc., it's impossible to sustain democracy, even if somehow it was implemented from outside or in some other manner. Now, a casual look at the data suggests that this Lipset hypothesis is correct. And some examples of it I've already mentioned. Chile, Korea, Taiwan, Spain, and Portugal were earlier examples. These are all cases where economic progress came first, and then it appeared perhaps as if the pressure from that somehow led to increased political rights, or at least one can make that argument. Various countries in Central and Eastern Europe are in a similar situation. They were oppressed for many years and had no political rights. And certainly my analysis, the Lipset hypothesis, does not explain that. But it does explain or suggest that there would be enormous pressures toward eventual increases in democracy, which eventually occurred. Now, as is my custom, I'd like to try to test these ideas in more of a formal statistical model, trying to measure the various concepts that are supposed to measure matter theoretically. Now, the basic framework that I've used is the following. I've used the Gastiel indicator of political freedom or democracy as the variable I'm trying to explain. And I'm not going to explain that just once per country, but I'm also going to try to exploit the fact that I have time series variation. I observe from 1960 to, say, 1994, the experience of the various countries. So I have a lot more than one observation for each country. What I've done specifically is that I've observed the level of political freedom at six different points in time over that sample. I started in 1972, which is actually the first year of the Gastiel data, and then I've got 1972, 1975, 1980, et cetera, until the last data point I had, which was for 1994. I suppose 1995 should be available pretty soon. I'll have to see about getting that. So the thing I'm trying to explain is these six different time observations of this measure of democracy. Now, the kinds of explanatory variables I've used are the ones that are suggested by the Aristotle-Lipset viewpoint. So in particular, I have a number of measures of standard of living or extent of prosperity, which the theory says should have a positive impact on democracy. So I've used basically lagged or prior measures of those kinds of variables. Now, this is going to include things like per capita income, life expectancy, and measures of education. Those are the three kinds of things I'm using as different ways of measuring the standard of living, because the theory isn't telling me more restrictively as exactly the way I ought to be measuring that concept. Now, in addition, I've measured some other variables which the political science literature has argued are supposed to matter for the extent of democracy. Included in that is the extent of urbanization. I think the usual view, which I didn't understand theoretically, is that more urbanization is supposed to mean more democracy. And if you look at the simple correlation in the data, that's true, but that doesn't turn out to be true in the overall analysis I have. Nor did I really understand the theoretical argument for that. But that's sort of true more broadly about this political science literature, so I guess I shouldn't be surprised by that. Now, another variable that's often mentioned is the size of a country. Is a big country more or less likely to be democratic than a small one? And there are a number of loose arguments that have been made that go one way or another on that, and I didn't really have a key critical understanding of this relationship, but I've included some measure of the size of a country. So before I tell you the results, you might think, do you believe that in general big countries are more or less likely to be democratic? I didn't really have a firm prior view myself on that question. There are a number of other variables I've looked at, which I'll talk about as I go through. But the basic setup is I have these various measures, especially measures of prosperity, which are supposed to tell you where, at least in the long run, the level of democracy is going to go. Now, in addition to that, you know where a country starts in terms of its level of political freedom. So, for example, in 1980, I might observe things like per capita income, education, et cetera, a whole list of variables. And this model is going to tell me, what does that predict in the long run about what the level of democracy ought to be that goes along with that? And then I also know what the actual level of democracy is, let's say in 1980, that is, I have the observation on this indicator. Now, the way I've set this up is that if it turns out that you're way above or below the level of democracy that the model predicts, I've set it up to allow a gradual adjustment process toward the value that's predicted by the economic variables. So if you take Singapore as an example, Singapore in the last observation has about 0.3 for democracy. The model predicts that the level of democracy ought to be something like 0.7 or 0.8, so it's way below it. Then I'm allowing that it might not be tomorrow that it becomes more democratic, but some kind of slow adjustment process toward the value predicted by the economic situation. So there's some kind of lag adjustment process allowed for in the model toward the value predicted by the economic variables. That's the nature of the statistical model. So the basic results in this framework are in Table 3, which I hope you have as part of the handout. So again, the thing that's being explained here is the observed value for democracy at various points in time for something around 100 countries. Now, one of the variables included on the right-hand side is the value of the democracy indicator 5 years earlier. That's getting into this gradual adjustment process. If you look at the first column of Table 3, you see the coefficient on that is about 2/3. Now, that means two things. That means if you're in a particular state with respect to democracy, there tends to be a lot of persistence over time, no matter what the values are for the other economic variables. So if I see that Singapore is not too democratic today, it's probably not going to be too democratic tomorrow or next year. Now, 2/3 means, or the other way to put it, is that the adjustment that occurs over 5 years is roughly 1/3 of the way toward what would be predicted by the economic circumstances. And then if you think about it over 20 years, you're going to get a lot of reversion toward the value predicted by the economic variables. That's what the model says, as estimated. That's what that coefficient means. Now, aside from that, I have a number of these indicators of the standard of living, which I've already indicated. So, for example, the log of real per capita gross domestic product, a measure of income, has a positive coefficient, as does life expectancy. Those are two indicators of the standard of living. They both go in a direction proposed by Lipset. So that means if you're more prosperous, you tend over time to become more democratic. Now, I should say in practice that the way more democracy usually occurs is through a discrete change rather than actually a gradual change. So you really want to think about this as influencing the probability that there'll be a change in any five-year period toward a more democratic regime. And if you have more economic prosperity, it becomes more probable that you'll get this change. The likelihood, though, is that when you get a change, it's probably going to be a big discrete change in one direction or the other. That's the way it actually tends to occur in the data. Now, another variable related to prosperity, which is particularly stressed in the political science literature, is education. And the two measures, using the same data set that I referred to yesterday, are measures of male and female primary school attainment. In contrast with growth and investment, where higher levels of education are what really seem to matter and to have predictive content, here it seems to be early education that's more significant, and average years of primary school attainment in particular has a lot of explanatory power. Now, you might notice, again, in column one of the table, that female primary attainment has a positive and highly significant coefficient. In parentheses is the standard error of the coefficient. The female primary schooling is actually the most important positive predictor of democracy. Male schooling enters with a negative sign. This is perhaps making up for my political incorrectness of yesterday, where I was picking on female schooling. Of course, I didn't think I was picking on it. I'm just trying to report what's in the data. A surprising aspect of these results is that at least once you're holding fixed income and life expectancy, the level of education actually is not predictive for democracy. What counts here is the relative amount of female and male schooling, which I think is something like the nature of educational opportunity. And it's really saying that if there's more equal educational opportunity across the sexes, that helps you predict increases in democracy coming later on. I don't have enough to tell you what the nature of the causation is there. This is saying that that's predictive of increases in political freedom. Now, I thought this might just be a measure of the inequality of education. Because one dimension of inequality in education is how much do females get relative to males. I might say in all of the major regions of the world, females have less educational attainment on average than males. But the nature of that spread is quite different depending on which region you're looking at. For example, if you look at the OECD countries or Latin America or the countries of Central and Eastern Europe, the gap between male and female is very small. But if you look in some other regions, especially South Asia and Africa, there's a tremendous gap where male schooling is much greater than female. In East Asia, it used to be the case that male schooling was much larger, but that's changed a lot over time. And if you look at it currently, the gap is now quite small in terms of current school enrollment. It's now quite small. So I thought that these results might be picking up something about inequality in education, of which the male-female is one dimension. However, as I will discuss later if I have time, I have a more detailed measure of educational inequality, and that turns out not to have much additional explanatory power, so it doesn't look like it's just picking that up. It looks like it's something more specific to the male-female breakdown. If you go down some of the other results in this column, the urbanization rate turns out to enter negatively. I say if you just look at a simple correlation between urbanization and democracy, it's strongly positive. But urbanization is also very correlated with other variables in here, like per capita income and education and life expectancy. And it turns out that once you hold those things constant, the influence, if I can put it that way, of urbanization on democracy is actually negative, but I don't really have a good story about that. Country size is statistically insignificant, has a positive coefficient, but it's not significant. So I think you'd say, as a rough cut, being bigger or smaller doesn't tell you much about whether a place is more likely to be democratic, which I found pleasing since I had no idea a priori which way that was supposed to go. Finally, another variable in here is a dummy for oil countries. Now, the general idea there is if we're thinking about prosperity, the relation of that to political freedom might be quite different if you're talking about accumulating human capital and improvements of industry versus if you just get a lot of per capita income by having more natural resources. And the oil dummy is a crude proxy for the idea about what happens if you just have higher income because you have natural resources, not because you had any other kind of economic development. So the negative sign on the oil countries says that just because they have high average income doesn't mean that they tend to be democratic. It tends to be the kind of income that's accompanied by increases in human capital and reproducible physical capital that's associated with more political freedom, not income that you get sort of for nothing. That's what that result suggests. Well, let me quickly tell you some more results which are in Table 4, which is also, I think, in your handout. If you look at number 3 in that table, I tried to look at whether inequality of income mattered. This is another favorite variable to rest in the political science literature. And the usual idea is that if a society is more unequal, and certainly Aristotle stressed this, that it's much more difficult to sustain democracy. Now, here I've used the available data on income inequality for various countries. I should say, however, that these data are very poor in quality, and the mismeasurement of inequality might reflect why it is that one doesn't get anything in these results. But what's basically true here is once I hold fixed the variables I've already discussed, there's no relationship between inequality of income and democracy. Now, there is a recent study at the World Bank, which I think has improved the quality of the data on income inequality substantially. And I haven't yet been able to use those data, so it will certainly be worth going back and looking at the better quality information. And I also need to study more the nature of the information, which I believe is better quality, but I haven't investigated yet in much detail. So it might be that one can go back to that later and find something which I haven't found yet here. As I also mentioned, I constructed a measure of educational inequality. And the underlying data set that I have on that allows me to do that in, I think, a fairly accurate manner. Now, it's just inequality based on years of schooling, years of school attainment, which I can measure at 7 different levels and thereby construct an inequality measure. This is line 4 in the table. Here you sort of get what you might think of as the right sign, more inequality meaning less democracy. but it's again not statistically significant. And you still get, for example, that the male-female schooling looks as it does in Table 3. It doesn't really destroy any of those results. So it doesn't seem to be that the measure of male and female schooling was just proxying for this inequality of schooling. Well, there are a number of other influences here that I'll skip over. I did try to look at the issue of whether economic freedom promotes political freedom and whether, in reverse, political freedom tends to promote economic freedom. Because some people have argued, especially Milton Friedman and Hayek, that these two kinds of freedoms are mutually reinforcing. You certainly see that in the sort of theoretical arguments, such as in Milton's Capitalism and Freedom book. I've used my measures of the rule of law, which I talked about last time, in conjunction with democracy to see whether it's the case that if you have higher, earlier values of the rule of law, that it tends to promote democracy later on. And I've also looked at that in the reverse direction. Neither of those directions of effect seem to be important. And statistically, you could accept the hypothesis that these things are independent. So I don't have any evidence here either that economic freedom makes political freedom more likely, or in reverse. The evidence doesn't seem to support either of those channels of hypothesis, which again are associated, as I mentioned, particularly with Hayek and Friedman. That doesn't mean that the hypotheses are wrong, but as I've been able to measure things, I can't really get any evidence to support that. Another effect that's been focused on in the literature is the effect of colonial status. It's been in particular argued that former colonies of Britain tend to be more democratic because of the brilliant upbringing they had under British tutelage. If you look at Table 5, you can see what the data look like on that. This shows a breakdown of 138 countries into their colonial status. Now, I have a fairly arbitrary definition of what it means to be a non-colony. Roughly speaking, any place that was independent from 1775 or earlier is arbitrary date. 1776 was when the Wealth of Nations was written. Any country independent as of or earlier than that is classified as a non-colony, but it's a little bit ambiguous because I put some places like, for example, Korea, and countries in Central and Eastern Europe as non-colonies, although you could argue that those should really be classified as colonies because of outside domination for a substantial number of years. The colonies are broken down, as you can see, into British, French, Spanish, Portuguese, and other colonies in the sample. And you can see, just by looking at the average values of the democracy indicators on the right-hand side, that there really is a pretty big difference between British colonies and in this sample also Spanish colonies, as to the average level of democracy in comparison with the French, Portuguese, and other colonies. British colonies and Spanish colonies tend to have democracy indicators that average between 0.5 and 0.6, whereas the other groups are more like 0.2 to 0.3, so it looks like there's a fairly substantial difference there. If you go back to Table 4, I then add colonial status into the statistical system. Number 7 just puts in whether or not you're a former colony. And number 8 breaks it down into what kind of former colony you were. The overall finding from that is that once you hold fixed the various economic variables that I've already discussed, per capita income, education, etc., colonial status explains absolutely nothing. Now, that doesn't mean that colonial status might not be important in some indirect manner, but if it's important for political freedom, it seems like it has to work indirectly through the economic variables, such as income and education, and not in some direct sense when you're holding those things constant. Because as I say, once you hold those things constant, even though there was a big difference between British Spanish colonies and some of the others, that all seems to go through the channel of income, education, etc., and not in some other manner. That's what the regression results indicate. Another influence that's had a lot of prominence in the literature is religion. And if you look back at Table 5 in the second part of it, you see how the majority religion in a country relates to its level of democracy. And there really is quite a pronounced difference here among the different religious groups. which is certainly not an original observation with me. This has been observed many times previously. As a rough statement, what you can say is that Protestant countries are almost always democratic. The average value of the indicator is roughly 0.9. You might want to add Greek Orthodox to that. I'm not sure about that. Whereas Muslim countries are almost always non-democratic. And there's a tremendous difference between the average value of the political indicator in those two groups. In fact, if you look at the Muslim countries, where the average democracy indicator from 75 to 94 is only about 0.3, there are only 4 out of 30 countries for which the average value of democracy averaged at least 0.5 over the period from 1975 to 1994. Those 4, if you care, are Gambia, Senegal, Malaysia, and Turkey. So there really is a pronounced pattern where, in this religious group, democracy is very low. So I did the same thing which I just discussed for colonial status. I included religious affiliation. What I really have is the breakdown of the overall population by percent in each country among various major religious groups. I added that to the statistical system, which is in line 9 of table 4. So if you go back to table 4, you can see the results when religious affiliation is included with all the other variables. The left out religion category is arbitrarily taken here to be Catholic. It doesn't really matter for the results which one you pick. It's just sort of normalizing things. Catholic is the dominant religion if you look at countries in an unweighted manner. So I'm looking at it sort of relative to that. You can think of that as being the baseline of 0, and then all the other religion coefficients should be interpreted as what's the effect on democracy relative to being Catholic. That's the way to interpret these coefficients. We can see, in contrast with the results that were in Table 5, Muslim and Protestant no longer look like a big deal. Protestant coefficient is insignificant. Muslim coefficient is negative but small in magnitude. So what that really says is that the big breakdown between Muslim and Protestant and the other ones is, again, held constant by the economic variables. And in particular, female schooling is going to be a big item here, which heavily distinguishes Muslim countries from Protestant ones. So again, the verdict here, I would say overall, is that once you hold fixed economic variables, religion doesn't seem to have a separate influence very much on the extent of democracy. It might be important indirectly by affecting these other variables, and that could be quite important, and it might be well worthwhile to investigate that further, which I'm trying to do currently. I might say, if you look in detail at the religion coefficients, the one that's actually pronounced and significant is for Hindu, which was not exactly anticipated. This really reflects a couple of outlier countries, and particularly in the data set. Turns out that India and Mauritius are quite surprisingly democratic. They don't have much, or not that much, prosperity, and they're basically full democracies over much of the sample. And the data have no way to explain that, so if you put in a Hindu dummy, it kind of likes that. But I wouldn't put much weight on that as being important, or at least I don't put much weight on that. Well, as I've already mentioned, you can use the results to generate forecasts of what the level of democracy or political rights will be in a country over time. You can predict how it will adjust, perhaps gradually, perhaps in a discrete probabilistic manner, toward the value predicted by the economic situation in a country. Now, those results are all compiled in Table 6. So if you have a favorite country, you can look at Table 6 and pick out where it was in 1975 and 1994. But roughly speaking, what I did in that table is the following thing. I said, suppose you have the various economic variables, which is basically per capita income, education, life expectancy, etc. And suppose you pretended that those variables were to remain constant over time. In fact, they tend to evolve gradually, but not in a drastic manner in a short period. But suppose you pretended that the economic situation were fixed, and then I allowed democracy to adjust to where it would in the long run, given the values of the economic variables. This would be an asymptotic or eventual kind of a process. Well, the projected values that are shown in the table are the results of that computation. So it's kind of a long-run target for democracy, as predicted by the various economic variables that I've used in the system. So if you look at the table, you can see the actual value of democracy for each country in 1975, the value projected by the theory as to what ought to be approached in the long run, and then the gap between actual and projected. And then similarly, that's done for 1994. So over a roughly period of a 20 years, you can see the adjustment that's occurred in the level of political rights. In boldface in the table is just shown the values of the gap that are large, defined here arbitrarily to be a magnitude of at least 0.33, whether plus or minus. So the boldface is just highlighting the values that depart a great deal from what the model says ought to be the long-run value of democracy. Now, it turns out in 1975 there were 13 countries that were below target by at least that number, 0.33, and only five above. And in 1994, because of the big global democratization that occurred since the middle 70s, that there were eight below target by that magnitude and 12 above. But you can see that if you look at the table. One of the surprises, perhaps, is there are only two countries on the whole list that enter with the same sign of large magnitude if you compare 1975 and 1994. In other words, there are only two places that are either below or above where you're supposed to be in the same way in 75 and roughly 20 years later. What that says is that there's a lot of reversion toward the long run value over 20 years. The statistical model said that in 5 years you should get one third of the way toward where you're going. So over 20 years you're going to go a lot of the way toward where you're going. And that's why there are only two places which turn out to be China and Yugoslavia, which both have negative gaps, that is, they both have much less political freedom than they ought to have in relation to the economic variables. But there are only two countries like that which are in the same drastic situation at the beginning and at the end of this particular sample. I suppose today you should identify Yugoslavia with Serbia. That's a little bit unclear, of course. You can look at the particular places. Let me just give you a few generalizations about regions. If you look at the African countries, there were only a few countries that were more democratic than you would have predicted at the beginning, that is in 1975. Gambia and Mauritius actually stand out there as being much more democratic than you would have predicted at that time in relation to the economic variables. I should say there was a coup in Gambia in 1994 which eliminated that discrepancy. I don't particularly mean to take joy at this observation. I'm just observing the facts here. Mauritius is still quite democratic, and the target value has risen considerably over time because the place has done very well economically, so it's no longer a big gap if you look in 1994. Many of the African countries were below the target for democracy in 1975 because you had a lot of virtual dictatorships at that time. As I already mentioned, there was a lot of democratization in Africa beginning in the end of the 1980s and carrying through to 1994. And particularly prominent there are a group of countries: Benin, Central African Republic, Guinea-Bissau, Malawi, Mali, Mozambique, Niger, and Zambia have all become almost full democracies as measured in the Gastille manner. And according to this model, they've dramatically overshot where they should have gone in relation to the economic variables. South Africa actually would be included among that group, but not as as an extreme extent. The model says that because the democracy has overshot the long-run value associated with economic variables, that probably it won't be sustained, and the prediction would be that democracy would diminish over time in the probabilistic way already discussed in those cases. There was actually a coup in Niger in January, which is relevant for that country, which is no longer a democracy as labeled in this table for 1994. Now, the model doesn't explain, as I mentioned, why these countries became so much more democratic that they overshot the mark. I think one of the influences there that's important to bring in is the pressure from international organizations, notably the IMF and the World Bank, which basically have done a lot of favors for countries, given them aid and other kinds of programs, if they have political changes that make them look more like democracy. So I think that's been an important element in the sense in which democracy has been imposed from outside in the recent years. At earlier times, the democracy was imposed by former colonial powers, at least as a temporary measure. In more recent times, I think the international organizations have played some of that role. Now, Haiti is a different case because that's a case where the United States went in and militarily imposed a political change which to some extent represented an increase in democracy. The model says in all of those cases, if democracy is imposed from outside without the supporting economic improvements, that probably it won't last and it will tend to decline over time. I mentioned South Africa is among that group, but quantitatively it's not as big there as in some other cases. The gas deal indicator is about 0.8 currently, or at least the last observation for South Africa. The model says it should be 0.6, so that's not such a drastic predicted change in that case. If you look at the Asian group among these countries, there were a number of countries that were basically non-democratic at the beginning of the period. Included there would be Taiwan, Bangladesh, Korea, and the Philippines, and also China. And the model predicted that those countries should become more democratic, and in most cases that has occurred, except for China. Singapore, as I already indicated, is also predicted to become more democratic, but it hasn't happened yet. And that's one of the biggest gaps if you look in 1994, along with China, which is also rated to be non-democratic. Hong Kong also looks like that, but of course, Hong Kong is a bit of a special case. I'm afraid my statistical model doesn't know that Hong Kong is going to become part of China next year, and so no account has been taken of that in the results. As I said, this is quite a big issue, particularly in a number of East Asian countries, and I seem particularly to get invited to talk about this topic in places like Singapore and Korea. So I think it'll be particularly interesting to see what happens in some of those places. I haven't yet been to Singapore, but I'm planning to go there soon, so I'm particularly eager to talk to them about this question. And hopefully if I don't chew gum and throw it on the sidewalk, I'll be okay in Singapore.
Now we have time for some questions, and I wonder if I could start the ball rolling by asking you a question about Russia and some of the other former Soviet republics, where we seem to have had some kind of an increase in democracy, but a very sharp dip in economic growth. I mean, how would those fit into your model if you had the statistics available and reliable, which you probably don't, but I'm sure we'd all welcome some comments on that situation.
In terms of my own data set, I should say that the only countries I have from the, I guess it's called formerly socialist or formerly planned economies, are Hungary, Poland, Yugoslavia, and China. In terms of the data, those are the only countries that are in the set. And of course, the prediction in the model was that these countries should become more democratic in relation to their economic situation. Now, that's particularly become true, certainly, for Hungary and Poland. Hungary actually overshot the mark, according to this model, and there's some prediction that it should become slightly less democratic. Yugoslavia, the prediction was that it should become more democratic, and if you identify it with Serbia, that certainly not occurred. And China, similarly, was predicted to become more democratic, and it hasn't happened. Russia wasn't part of this data set, but I believe if it were true, it would look similar to some of these cases, where the prediction would have been in relation to the economic circumstances, that it should, of course, have become much more democratic than it was. I think it's probably correct that the democratization that occurred there substantially overshot the mark, and to some extent that would be an adverse influence, that would be predicted from this model in comparison with a more gradual increase in democracy, more like the cases in East Asia, for example. But I can't say from this model that the level of democracy is critical for growth. Because this issue always comes up in the contrast between China and Russia, where China has had some economic liberalization and essentially no political liberalization, and that some people argue has been quite favorable, where Russia had economic liberalization and at the same time big political changes, and that was thought to be quite disruptive. That might be correct, but I can't say that the results that I have from my data set would have predicted that that would be the crucial variable. I think what's probably true in the case of Russia is that at the same time that you had the political changes, you also had the destruction of anything that looked like rule of law or rule of anything. And I think that's probably a critical element, that there's sort of no rules as to how things occur. But there's no big evidence in the data that I have that that typically accompanies big changes in political freedom or democracy in one direction or another. So I wouldn't have said that it was the increase in political freedom per se that was doing it, but the collapse of the rules of the game, I suspect, would end up being a critical element in the Russian case if I had the data on that, which I can probably construct some estimates for that case, but I am missing some of the variables.
Questions from the floor in the gallery? Yes.
I'm not sure what you mean about information and how I would measure it. Now, of course, the education variables are no doubt proxying in part for that. You can get information about newspaper coverage and other kinds of communications media, but I'm not quite sure what you have in mind about how I would measure the extent of information. In the theoretical literature, such as it is, that's been argued to be important, more information being a check on the power of the officials in power. And it's thought in that literature that education particularly operates in that manner, and that's why more education might be a constraint on the autocratic tendencies. But I'm not sure if you have something in mind about what kind of alternative measure I might get more directly for measuring that. I should say in general that this hypothesis associated with Lipset about measures of the standard of living being positively related to subsequent democracy is something that looks like a very strong empirical regularity, but the theory behind it is quite weak. So it's kind of a case where the analysis works in practice but not in theory, which is the opposite about what's often true in economics. I guess my own narrow viewpoint as an economist is that we're not going to get the theory if we leave it up to political scientists, who have so far mainly been the group that have been offering theories in this realm. But that doesn't mean up to this point.
Right.
Do you think that China's economic growth is sustainable without political liberalization?
Again, China is another case which is only partly in my own study. I have it in this particular discussion I've been doing today. It wasn't actually in the results that I discussed yesterday about economic growth, but I think estimate what it would look like. I think the overall experience suggests that, yes, you can sustain rapid economic growth without having a lot of political freedom, but as a predictive matter, as prosperity accumulates, you do tend to get more political freedom. So if you ask me what would I predict, I would predict that you'd find more democratization. I'd say the probability of that is rising, and it continues to do so the more the economy prospers. Nevertheless, you can find examples of cases which have not democratized and have done pretty well. And indeed, if you democratize too much, I'd say it's somewhat of a negative force, but I wouldn't say it was the most critical of forces that I've been able to isolate. So I don't think that one way or another, more political freedom in China is going to be the critical matter. I think things related more to economic rights, rule of law and such, is more important. I don't have a good theory of how to implement that, but I think it's basically independent of this political freedom kinds of changes. That's what the data seem to suggest.
Thank you.
I've thought about that a little bit, but I haven't tried alternative ways, because in fact you could constrain the fact that I'm really only observing, first of all, I'm only observing 7 discrete categories of democracy. That's the way the data come. A part of that is that you can't go beyond 0 or beyond 1, but then in the middle there are only these discrete levels. And then in fact what you have is probabilities of transition from one discrete category to another. I convinced myself that the linear approximation to that is not going to be a big deal. In some other contexts, I've looked whether the sort of cardinal nature of this variable as I've imposed it matters by looking at different groups separately. I've done that when I've looked at the relation of democracy to growth, and that didn't matter a great deal. But in terms of actually predicting what will happen to democracy, I've not implemented a more serious kind of probability transition model. My prior on that is that it's not going to make a great deal of difference, but I have not done it, and I can't say that for sure.
Right, let me hear.
Yeah, I think the general prediction, which I don't say that I've confirmed, is that democracy is one of the things that promotes more of a welfare state, and that in turn would have adverse influence on incentives and therefore on investment and growth. That would be the theory. I'm trying to look more directly at that channel by measuring various aspects of welfare state. And in terms of my gut feeling, I feel that that's a critical variable, especially in Western Europe, which is kind of the most advanced in terms of welfare state, and indeed also very important in Eastern Europe, which has remarkably developed institutions for things like retirement pensions and such and can't really afford it. I believe that this is quite important for growth, and I would include in that also things about regulations, especially of labor markets. I have not, however, been able to confirm that directly by measuring aspects of welfare programs or restrictions on labor markets or other aspects of regulations. So I don't have direct evidence confirming that, although I believe that that would be a channel whereby this influence would arise. And I'm trying to look at this further by getting better measures of these kinds of influences, welfare state variables and regulatory kinds of variables. So I would like to be able to say more on that, but at the moment I don't have that evidence.
I mean, my impression is that this comes through in terms of the ability of states to finance the level of welfare rather than the absolute level of government spending on welfare. You have countries in Western Europe which have quite high public spending ratios compared to the UK and the US, for example, which have just as rapid or even more rapid rates of growth. But once they start getting into deficit problems and paying high rates of interest, then maybe that's when the welfare state becomes an adverse factor. I don't know, this is all a bit conjectural.
That's not my theory, but I don't claim to have empirical evidence. I mean, the model for me, of course, is Sweden, which sort of went beyond all conceivable reasonable behavior in terms of the extent of the welfare state. And it's not really a question of budget deficits. It's a question of having to finance that in a very distorting manner, which basically gives people no incentive to do anything productive.
any Swedes in the audience?
You know, the fact that you can get away with that kind of policy for a long time if you basically started with a lot of human capital and a lot of economic development. But particularly in the long run, you'd expect it to have very adverse consequences, and I think that's been true in Sweden for the last 10 or more years. But what I've not been able to do, and what I'm not claiming here, is to be able to measure that kind of influence more generally in a quantitative manner, and then demonstrate what the effect of that is in some systematic manner on economic growth after holding constant some of the other influences that I'm discussing. So this is really conjecture about what I think is true. I don't really claim to have the quantitative evidence to back that up.
Well, there's a gentleman up there. Is he propping up his arm or asking a question? Right at there.
Well, implicitly, the statistical model tells you not only about the current growth rate, but how it will be sustained over time, which I don't particularly find in this analysis that something that spurs growth currently, or in the sense of a 5 or 10 year period, does something spectacularly different with respect to long-term growth. Rather, what you get here is a more uniform kind of convergence process, where if you do something like have a more efficient underlying system, you get higher growth in the short run, and gradually that would converge back to something lower, but it wouldn't be dramatically different. Now, I have looked at other measures of prosperity aside from things like real per capita gross domestic product. I've looked at how things like, for example, life expectancy and infant mortality rates and levels of schooling, how those are influenced by a number of determining forces. So I don't have to just take a narrow view about a pure economic variable. Indeed, you can regard democracy as one of the things that people like, whether or not it promotes growth. And then looking at what promotes democracy is another part of the vector of things that people might care about, so that economic growth and accumulations of levels of income would be one dimension, but you also have these other ones. I don't, of course, know exactly how to weigh the different parts. I don't know how to weigh the growth rate against more or less democracy, against more or less life expectancy if there's a trade-off, but I can say something individually about how various policies contribute to these different dimensions.
I think you do have a supplementary on that.
I haven't looked at that in my research. I mean, the research that I know of suggests that you kind of need, or at least in a certain range, higher levels of income help you deal better with the environment. And as a predictive matter, if you become more prosperous, you tend to do better with the environment. Now, it might well be that a middle level of countries does the worst in certain respects with respect to environmental pollution. But it certainly seems to be the case that if you look at the highest income countries, those are not the ones that are doing bad things to the environment. And it doesn't look like there's a trade-off there by which if you have more growth and higher levels of income that you're somehow giving up features of the environment. I say that might be true in a middle range is what I understand about these results. These are not my own research results because I have not, in fact, focused on that question.
Thank you. Another one up there, yes?
Well, I mean, the underlying variable tries to do that, but in an admittedly subjective manner. It doesn't look at just whether elections are held, by which, for example, Singapore would have been rated as highly democratic. It tries to look at whether all adults are allowed to participate in the process, whether the elected officials actually matter for policies, whether minority groups have some kind of political influence. On the civil liberty side, it looks at the actual practice with respect to freedom of speech, religion, assembly, etc. I don't believe that's a critical problem with respect to this measure. I should confess pretty fast that my knowledge of Gambia is quite limited. The main thing I knew about was the coup in 1994. I don't really know what to add to that. For that case, of course, I was accepting the measure that was compiled in this particular data set. One surprising country in Africa is Botswana, which I know has a multi-party political structure, which it's had for quite a long time. And that is quite an outlier in Africa. That one I know a little bit more about.
Any Gambians here, please stay behind afterwards and have a private discussion with Professor Barrow. Yes.
Hopefully not. Well, in terms of fostering rates of economic growth, that would be, I think, the right interpretation of these results, such as they are, which I don't want to overstress the strength of the results. But I don't mean to say that economic growth is the sole objective of reasonable policy. So, for example, in the context of Korea or Taiwan, there may have been some kind of decision that it was worth trading off high economic growth for the benefits from political liberalization. And I have no reason to question that judgment. In that sense, beyond a certain point, democracy is a luxury good, which you buy more of as you become wealthier. And you're willing to buy more of it, even though in a certain range it has some adverse consequences on the rate of economic growth. So I have no reason to think that there's a mistake if that's what's occurring. This is more in the realm of positive analysis of describing what the consequences would be.
Time for one more, perhaps. There, one frustrated questioner. Right, now you won't be frustrated. Yeah.
On the first point, I think in terms of a statistical model, the right unit of observation is something like the country, where I'm thinking of political choices which apply for the whole country. So in that sense, in the first cut, I probably want to treat each observation roughly equally weighted, independently of what the size of the country is. But I agree, if you want to think about the consequence of the political regimes, then you probably want to weight it by the population. So I don't have any quarrel with your doing that and arguing that sort of China and India are more important than the weight I give them. I think to estimate the model, I don't really want to give them a lot more weight. But for some other purpose, I can see why you might want to do that. As a general observation about this data set, to some extent, from the point of being an objective observer, I don't want to know that much about the data. Of course, I want to know that the data are sort of reliable and they match up with other measures that you might want to construct about civil liberties and democracy. But probably I don't want to get into too much about, well, is this a mistake? Is that a mistake? And of course, there are a lot of quarrels about particular countries that have arisen in this classification. I probably don't want to start manipulating the data in that manner. I think that would be a mistake, even if I could identify certain things that I would argue were errors. India was classified as being pretty much a full democracy earlier on, and then less than a full democracy later, which I think particularly has to do with the perceived view of the minority groups in the country, in the political process. But this, I agree, is a fuzzier concept in general in this classification, so I wouldn't want to push it really far. On the other hand, I wouldn't want to make adjustments in the variable to conform to my beliefs there. I don't remember in terms of data set when it was that India was labeled as having become less democratic. I only have here 1975, 1994. I don't recall when in the sample that that change occurred, and I wouldn't particularly try to defend it too greatly. China, I don't think there's a real argument about the measurement, but there is a big gap between what's predicted, that is, it should become more democratic in response to the pressure from economic prosperity being greater. I think it's reasonable that the model has that prediction. At the same time, it's true that there's a gap between the current circumstance and where the model says the situation would go in the longer run. I think that's kind of an accurate way to view the situation there.
Well, thank you very much, Robert, for an extremely stimulating lecture. And thank you also for dealing with the questions in such a very sympathetic way. And let me just remind everybody that we have had a lecture appropriate to the London School of Economics and Political Science. You have linked the two together in an extremely enlightening manner. Thank you again.